When a person accuses a test of being biased, they're essentially saying that the test is not measuring the same way in one group as it is in another group, and therefore, the results that you might get are distorted and not the true picture of a person's capabilities.
Welcome back to the Human Intelligence Podcast. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about test bias. Our guest today is Craig Frisby, who is an emeritus faculty member at the University of Missouri and one of the world's experts on intelligence testing and test bias. He is also the author of a brand new book called Essentials of Evaluating Bias in Intelligence Testing. Don't let the title deceive you. There's not a lot of crazy math formulas and complex stuff. It's written very much for the test user or maybe even the interested layman. And that's why I wanted to bring you on the episode of the podcast today, Craig, so we can talk about test bias. Since you're very comfortable doing so with non-experts, people, the sort of people who would be in our audience. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you give me a short summary of your book, please?
Yes, the book was written in response to my frustrations because I would be occasionally asked to give webinars on the broad topic of non-discriminatory testing and test bias. And I would find that the couple of hours that I was allotted to do that just wasn't enough. I was trying to cram in a lot of information in these webinars, and it was just too much information for people to truly digest. So I contacted Wiley and tried to interest them in the possibility of adding to their Essentials series a book that would talk about IQ test bias, where it gives the reader an opportunity to slow down. And what I tried to do is basically take the perspective of the practitioner and just have the practitioner walk through the different phases of test selection and test usage, test scoring and test interpretation, and try to tease out some of the accusations of bias that we typically encounter, and then try to answer those accusations with what the literature says. Hmm. So the book is 10 chapters, and again, it just walks the practitioner through different phases of their use of tests and tries to explain what the criticisms are and then see how the criticisms are answered by actual research.
And there is a lot of research on this because these criticisms and these accusations of test bias go back a long, long time.
Yes, they do.
And so it is very impressive. You can boil down literally decades of research, mm-hmm. make it digestible for the intelligent, interested layman, and you know, package it up in one book. But I see why it would take more than just a couple hours to talk about
yes.
this. And we're not going to be able to talk about all of it in one podcast episode.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in the chapter called IQ test bias, what it is and what it is not. How do psychologists define bias, and what are some examples of what other people incorrectly call bias?
Well, we can start with the incorrect ideas first, and if we can take ourselves back to before we went to school, or what we would regularly hear on TV shows and by even people that we know what they say about tests, you'll typically hear the phrase, well, IQ testing or mental testing is culturally biased. That's the phrase that's typically used. And what's typically meant by that is, first of all, the observation that different groups display different distribution, mean distributions in scores. There's tremendous overlap in scores across different social groups. Mm-hmm. But if you've taken an introductory psychology class or what have you, you will see very quickly that different groups within American society do not achieve the same mean score in the distribution of intelligence test scores. So that's the primary piece of data that causes many people to say that IQ tests are culturally biased. And if you want a popular culture reference to that, many folks may have seen the movie Boys in the Hood. Mm-hmm. This was back in the 90s, and
I'm a child of the 90s, so I definitely know Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, and there's a central character. You know, the overall theme of that movie is that, you know, it shows the difference between groups of friends, some of which don't have a father figure in the home and others that do. And the central father figure is a very assertive, strong, principled man who says at one point in the movie, well, everyone knows that testing is culturally biased. And the only thing that is not biased is math, but everything else is culturally biased. And of course, that was an idea that came from the director of the movie, but it's a very popular idea that still persists today, despite research evidence, solid research evidence, mm-hmm. that refutes it. Mm-hmm. So many times I've read scholars in intelligence research bemoan the fact that there's two separate universes, so to speak. There's one universe of the layman who thinks that tests discriminate unfairly against groups that are poor or minority, and the other universe that basically says we've done a lot of research with tests and they are appropriate and they're comfortable to be used with mm-hmm. any American group where the test takers are American born and English speaking.
And that's what we say with the riot is we say, look, this test is designed for American adults who are born in the United States and who speak English as a native language. And that's a really common population for tests like the Woodcock-Johnson and the Wechsler test. There's other tests, obviously, for other populations. But yeah, with the riot, we said, you know, we're going to examine the largest cultural groups within this American population. So if that's what non-experts say is bias, what would be the definition that someone like you or I would have of test bias? What would that be, and how would we know it when we see it?
Well, as you know, that there are many different kinds of possible bias, but if I wanted to reduce it down to the main idea is measurement error. In other words, when a person accuses a test of being biased, that they're essentially saying that the test is not measuring the same way in one group as it is in another group, and therefore the results that you might get are distorted. They're not the true picture of a person's capabilities. And so when a test is not measuring the same way in one group compared to another group, then our interpretations may be off. So if we see, for example, a group of individuals that achieve certain scores, and maybe their scores might be low, we might suspect that, gee, if there wasn't anything wrong with the test, their scores might be higher. Mm. And therefore, we might be more accurate in decision-making about those people. So measurement error is the primary idea that you and I, as academics, would understand tests bias to be. It's not measuring the same way mm-hmm. in individuals from one group as it is for individuals from another group.
Got it. So this would be measurement error that is the sort of systematically applying to members of one group more than another, or maybe exclusively to one group. And I don't know about you, but error sounds bad. I don't want error in my test. And mm-hmm. so the test creator's perspective is, let's get rid of this error, you know. I like what you said about how we might get different score distributions for different groups. So the outsiders are saying, well, that's evidence of test bias. But from what you're saying, it seems to me that that might be a reason to investigate test bias. So maybe those score differences are the beginning mm-hmm. of the test bias investigation, not the end of it. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, the general idea there that we as academics are trying to model for people is that we want to go into the testing enterprise without any preconceived ideas. So by preconceived ideas, I mean that we don't want to go into testing with this idea that there are differences in distributions between groups because we don't know. And in the same way, we don't want to go into testing with the preconceived ideas that all groups have to give equal results in terms of the mean distributions. We want to have an open mind, and we want to use our statistical tools to rigorously evaluate tests. And therefore, if we have confidence in what we're doing in our measurement, then whatever we get as our results are whatever we get. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you know this, we've observed mean differences in IQ score distributions ever since the beginning of testing. Mm-hmm. So there hasn't been any epoch within testing in which groups get the same distributions. And that is an outcome that occurs on every country on Earth, regardless of what groups are in those countries. Mm-hmm. So even though you might have a country that has a majority of a group within one broad racial or ethnic group, if you break down racial or ethnic groups, you will see that there will be differences in distributions mm-hmm. among the subgroups within that country. So for users to believe that you have to find equal mean scores distributions in every group, that has shown time and time again to be an elusive outcome. Mm-hmm. In no country on Earth do you see equal distributions in mean score distributions among groups, no matter how you cut up the groups.
Yeah. And I would also say, not only do we come in with the assumption of, hey, we don't know what we're going to get, let the data fall where it may as far as examinee scores, I would also mm-hmm. say, as a test creator, I came in when I screened my subtests and my items for bias, I said, I'm not going to come in with preconceived notions about whether the items we wrote were biased or not. You know, mm-hmm. it works mm-hmm. both ways. Yes. I'm not going to come in under the assumption that the test is all hunky-dory. I'm also not going to come in under the assumption that the test needs to have certain outcomes either way. I'm just going to let the data fall where it may.
Yeah, and the tragedy of this is that, you know, we operate within the context of political conflicts, and this occurs within any society. So we find very quickly that if our results give us outcomes that are not in harmony with a particular political ideology or what have you, then tests are basically maligned. And mm-hmm. it's very easy to blame outcomes in societies on bad measurement. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the uphill battle for us as psychometricians and academics, is that if we are being accused of bad measurement, then we have to demonstrate to test consumers that our measurement is good and accurate and vetted.
Which, to be fair, they're the consumers, they're the customers. Mm-hmm. They have a right to say, hey, demonstrate to us that your test does meet high standards of reliability, validity. And if you want to add fairness in it, I think that's completely legitimate. Mm-hmm. That being said, it is a little tiresome, I'm sure, for you to hear for decades, the tests are biased, when you know that mm-hmm. they're not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what causes test bias, as professionals understand the term, on intelligence tests?
Well, a test would be biased if you are using items in your measurement instrument that may be very much unfamiliar to a particular group. So the most obvious example of that is if I were to sit down with a child and I were to administer the entire test in Spanish, and all of the words that I use would be in Spanish, but the child speaks only English. that's an obvious example of a test that would be not appropriate for that child. Or if there is a test item that is supposed to show a higher probability of brighter people passing it, then we see when the same item is given to people of lower ability, if an item does not behave in that way, then it's not measuring what we want it to measure, because we should find for every item in a test that as you go up in the underlying trait, which is in this case would be general mental ability or higher intelligence, that the more general mental ability you have in your group, the higher probability they would have to pass the item. And that's just a basic requirement for all items in an IQ test. And if an item is not behaving in that way, then that would be an item that would be not appropriate for that test. So that would introduce bias.
So for group A, we have easy items, medium items, hard items. But for group B, if you have the easy items are the same as group A's easy items, and then the other ones, there's no distinguishing factor between group, you know, the medium and the hard items, or mm-hmm. maybe the harder items for group A are easier for group B or vice versa. Now we have bias going on.
Yes.
And by far the easiest thing to do for someone on my end is to throw out the items that aren't working well and then just keep the items that work the same way for both groups. And yeah. that seems to be standard practice.
Yeah. A general way to think about it is if you take your group and then ask the question, what is the hardest item in group A? That would need to be also, that same item would also need to be the hardest item in group B and the hardest item in group C. Then you ask, what is the easiest item in group A? That item would need to be the easiest item in group B and C as well. So it's the rank order of the difficulty that you want to be the same across all groups.
Nice. What are some of the consequences of an inaccurate view of test bias?
Boy, that is a really loaded question, because as I think about that, it takes me back to when I was a graduate student and I didn't know anything about testing at all. I tended to find that it's easier for politicized ideas to be more prominent than scientific ideas. So when I was starting my graduate school work in the early 1980s in California, the context of my graduate school work was in the middle of the Larry P. trial in California. And you had a lot of commentary and ideas surrounding that trial, where even many school psychologists and school psychology programs bought into this idea that tests are biased, tests are bad. It's great that we get rid of them. We'll teach the tests because we have to, but we're going to hold our nose, and we are going to put more emphasis on what they called at the time alternative testing. So one negative consequence of having the wrong ideas is that you're bashing tests that don't need to be bashed, because there's really nothing wrong with how they operate, but we're bashing them anyway because the political groups that are very strong and prominent say that they're bad, they're biased, and they might convince innocent folks who are just trying to understand the literature, they're convincing them that tests should not be used, or if they are used, that their results should not be trusted. So that's a very negative consequence. And of course, we saw in California that when you ban tests from being given in schools, and in this case, it was tests were banned to be administered for Black students in California schools for any purpose at all, then you're left with inferior modes of measurement, and you're not using the best instruments. And, you know, one of the things that psychology can brag about is that behavior modification and intelligence testing are one of the top two most useful contributions from psychology at all time. And if you're telling practitioners you can't use these tools, then you're left with more inferior tools that are less reliable and less valid. And that degrades the work of the practitioner because they cannot use the best tools out there.
Yeah, because the Larry P. case, from what I understand, banned, as you said, intelligence testing for African-American students in California public schools. There were then thousands of school psychologists who still had to diagnose. They still had to assess, and now they didn't have the best tool available to them. They had to make do with something else, and it sounds like it was an inferior alternative. And that it really, in the long run, probably didn't do anyone any favors.
Yes, it didn't at all. And I've, from what I understand, now I wasn't living in California in the 90s at all, but when I talked to colleagues that did live in California, all of the training programs were just caught in disarray, and they were crying out, well, what can we use? What can we use? And there was no direction from the California State Department of Education. So my understanding is that what most practitioners did is they probably just looked at group administered achievement test scores, data from teacher interviews, and looking at the kids' grades and the kids' performance in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But even if you take all of those things together, it takes time to gather information. And one of the beauty of well-developed IQ tests is that within an hour and a half, you get a score that is highly predictive of academic outcomes. And so whenever California school psychologists had to assess a Black student, they basically were left with trying to go on their own using all of these other methods. And it was just time consuming, and it was not precise, and it was not accurate. But what we found out from that is that the rates of special education assignment for Black students didn't change at all. And so even though you got rid of IQ tests, you still had an overabundance of Black students in classes for the intellectually disabled. Mm-hmm. And so that was one piece of evidence to say, well, maybe banning IQ tests don't give you the kinds of outcomes that you think we should get, because maybe there was something legitimate about what IQ tests would tell you.
I would agree. And as far as the school psychologist situation where they're one-on-one with the child, not only do you get that great data and that great score, but it also gives the psychologist a lot of opportunity to observe the child's behavior. You mm-hmm. know that kid who can't do more than three items without getting up out of their chair might have ADHD. Mm-hmm. As an example, mm-hmm. you really can learn an extraordinary amount of information about a person from just sitting down with them and testing them for an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Sure. And we also need to keep in mind that the only reason that anyone would ever give an individually administered IQ test in schools is from a teacher referral. The teacher has had his or her classroom for a number of months now, and they're noticing that Johnny is doing poorly on his class assignments. He's not turning in homework. He seems slower to catch on and what have you. So the only reason why we would even assess Johnny is because the teacher is noticing something in his or her classroom that they want to see or try to improve in some way. And it is helpful when teachers get information back to say, well, Johnny is a little bit slower than the other kids in terms of understanding, grasping abstract material, grasping material that is a little bit too complex, and he's falling behind. And that's a valuable piece of information that would say to both teachers and parents and administrators that this child needs a special class. And it's the same way for the other extreme of the distribution. If you have a child who's just ripping through his assignments and he seems to be understanding things faster and he's bored in the classroom because he wants more complicated and higher level work. It's helpful for that teacher to get information to say, well, yeah, this child has a very, very high IQ, very, very mentally advanced, and maybe we should consider gifted placement or maybe even advance the child a grade because of what he's showing us. So,
and you don't get that if you ban the test. You're throwing away that useful information. Yeah, maybe you can gather it from other places. It sounds like California psychologists did. But why pass up this really efficient, well-designed tool?
Mm-hmm.
If you enjoy this conversation, like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode of the Human Intelligence Podcast. Also, leave a comment so we know what you're thinking about what we're talking about here. You can also follow us on social media at the links below. Now, back to the rest of the episode.
Let's talk about test content. Mm-hmm. One common strategy for arguing that IQ tests are biased is to pick out a couple of items that maybe seem a little more culturally loaded, or maybe they have pictures of males or pictures of white or black or Asian or whatever mm-hmm. group. And then say, look, this is culturally specific. That means this whole test is not fair.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that a bad strategy for identifying bias?
Well, one of the things I'll just want to say right off the bat, that when you analyze books that have been written about the Larry P. trial, this was the trial in California in the late 70s, in which on the plaintiff's side, you had... I think it was the Association of Black Psychologists that were arguing for the plaintiffs that tests were biased. And you just beautifully captured their strategy. What they would do is they would pick out an item from an IQ test and then basically hold it up to ridicule. So to give you an example, one popular item that they picked out, I think it was the whisk that was in use at that time. It was a comprehension item that basically said, well, what are you supposed to do when the child much smaller than yourself starts to fight with you? And the proper answer for that was, well, I would show some kind of restraint. Now the plaintiff psychologist in the Larry P. trial argued that, well, no, in black culture, because sometimes many cultural situations are very, very, there's a lot of violence and bullying and so forth and so on. The proper response, they argued, for a black child would be to hit back. So they would make the argument that, yeah, the whisk is biased because here's an example of an item that is not appropriate for black culture, supposedly. And as you point out, the problem with that is, number one, Well, there's two basic problems. Number one, any item that you pick out from an intelligence test is on a continuum of easy to difficult. So if a child of any race misses that item, you can't assume that it was because of their culture, simply because that item has a certain difficulty level. And so it could be that a child misses that item only because they're younger, or they might be lower in terms of their mental ability. So they're missing it not because of the cultural content, but just because of cognitively, it's not appropriate to their age level. So that's one thing that was missed in the Larry P. trial. The second thing that was missed, and I bring this out in the book, those kind of arguments were persuasive to Judge Peckham, who presided over the Larry P. trial. But there was a similar trial that happened in Chicago, the Posse versus Hannon trial, and Judge Grady presided over that trial, and he came to the opposite conclusion. And one of the reasons why the Chicago trial had the opposite conclusion is because the judge said, we need data. If you are arguing that this particular item is more difficult for black children than it is for white children, Grady said, I want to see the data that shows that. And if that were indeed true, we would see no black children passing that item at all. Mm-hmm. But when independent researchers actually studied that, they found that that item behaved the same way within a black group as it did in a white group. In other words, the younger you were, the lower you were in your general mental ability, the less probability you had to pass that item. But regardless of your group membership, as you rose up in general mental ability, the probability of you passing that item increased as well. So the truth is that that item was no more difficult for black children than it was for white children. But the way that those arguments are persuasive is that you could basically justify any hypothetical outcome. And if you didn't know anything about tests, you would find yourself saying, well, yeah, that seems to be reasonable, that if you grew up in this violent culture or whatever, you would fight back. Yeah, that makes sense. It may make sense to you, but the proof of the pudding is you have to have data behind your accusations to see if something is true or false. And what we found out years after the Larry P. trial, that many of the arguments that the plaintiff psychologists used about this item is bad because of these cultural reasons or what have you, it didn't bear out in the data. There was nothing wrong with those items. Black children had the same probability the same rank ordering of easy to difficult. That was the same in black groups than it is and also in white groups. So the lesson behind that is, yeah, you may hear something that may sound plausible to you, but the proof of the pudding is in the data. And what I try to show in the book is I try to walk practitioners through, if someone criticizes any particular item in an IQ test, here is the way that psychometricians evaluate those claims. And if you're the practitioner, here is what you would look for in the manuals to give you evidence that that particular claim is either legitimate or not legitimate.
Got it. And it all comes back to, does this item function the same way for one group as it does for another?
Yes.
And I guess you can't decide that just by eyeballing the item.
Right.
You got to collect data.
That is not a good method for determining bias at all.
Another argument from critics is based on the administration and scoring procedures. They say that those might be biased. So on traditional intelligence tests that you administer face-to-face, the administrator follows the test instructions very clearly. They read the directions out loud, word for word. They give a set amount of time for every item, and they score responses as right or wrong in a very rigid way with the same key. Some people see this as embodying the dominant culture's way of thinking. What's the harm with being more flexible in administering tests to individuals or groups who may struggle with the tests?
There's a lot to say about that, so I'm going to try to be very brief, but I
it was a long question. I'm sorry about that.
It was a good question as well, because one of the things I wanted to add is that when I began as a graduate student in 1980, I knew nothing about anything. I knew nothing about testing or what have
Same.
You. But our training program stressed that, you know, in preparing for our doctoral exams, we had to go to the literature and do literature reviews in an area of interest. And so I was interested at the time in testing. So what was popular at that time was Reuven Feuerstein's work in dynamic assessment. Mm-hmm. Reuven Feuerstein was an Israeli psychologist that practiced in Israel, and he was the head of an organization that basically was required to process many Israeli refugees, children of families that were impoverished, children of families that went through war and so forth and so on. So he developed an entire assessment philosophy that basically argued that traditional, quote unquote, traditional IQ tests were static measures that didn't give kids the opportunity to display what they could do. So he was the prominent person at the time that would make that argument that you just said, that if we want to accurately assess the intelligence, particularly of disadvantaged groups that have gone through many horrendous social situations, what we need to do is we need not to be standardized in our administration, but we needed to be flexible. And, you know, if a child would give an answer, we would need to basically prime him or prompt him toward the right answer. We would need to give the child opportunities to learn how to do the item and perform the item. And then we need to test him again to see how much he's learned. And so in graduate school, I had to read a lot of his books. And if you and he had two main books. One was called The Dynamic Assessment of Retarded Performers. It was published in 1979. And then another book was called Instrumental Enrichment, published in 1980. And all throughout that book, he was just bashing traditional IQ tests. The examiner, you know, was this mummy that couldn't be friendly to kids. And so the kids were answering things and they didn't know why they got the answer wrong. And the examiner couldn't help him and so forth and so on. So at that time, I bought into all that, but I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about traditional testing or traditional test research. So the bottom line is I began to discover that, boy, a lot of what these writers are saying is just wrong. They are caricaturing traditional IQ tests. Traditional IQ tests do give opportunities for kids to learn the task when they begin, where the examiner can demonstrate how you do the task. The examiner is encouraged to be friendly and to be open and to be warm and to be cordial and to elicit the best responses from the test taker. And you also find out from some of the best psychometricians that when you use a gain score, and a gain score is basically where you test a kid at one point in time, you then expose them to training in how to do the test items, then you test them again after you've trained them, if you get a gain in the score, they would argue that that's the true measure of potential. It's not a static one-time IQ score, but you have to test the child twice. In the middle, you're teaching the child, and if they get higher scores, that's the true measure of potential. Well, as a psychometrician, you know that gain scores are notoriously unreliable. And psychometricians of the time would show us mathematically why using a gain score in that way, violating the standardization, is death for you trying to accurately interpret scores. And just as an aside, in Eliot's book, Litigating Intelligence, he would go into detail to show us how the plaintiff psychologists in the Larry P. trial, when they tested the same plaintiff children, they completely distorted all of the standardization rules. And they basically prompted kids. They basically gave them hints. They gave them extra time. They rephrased questions. And they did all of this violation of standardization. And eventually the kids got maybe IQs in the low 90s. Then they went to court and said, see, this is the true IQ of the child. But they completely violated any kind of standardization rules. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you can't properly interpret test scores. You have to stick to the standardization. You know, that was a kind of a long-winded answer, but the basic answer to what you said is that when you violate the standardization rules of well-developed tests, you render the scores practically uninterpretable.
Mm-hmm. So if we decide, well, maybe some groups need a little more hints, a little more time, it sounds like, just like with Larry P., the solution, you know, the cure is worse than the disease. We get lower quality data. It's less reliable and less interpretable. And it doesn't really solve our fundamental problem of being able to measure people's abilities well. And that's what we really care about at the end of the day. We wouldn't care about test bias if we didn't care about being able to measure people's abilities accurately. So that makes sense to me.
And let me just add this very, very quickly. One of the things you mentioned in your response there, and an area in which we need to better educate practitioners, is this notion of the group versus the individual. Okay. And what we typically do is whenever we read test critics that say tests are biased or what have you, almost invariably what they do is they make statements and comments about groups as an abstraction. This group thinks this. This group will do this. And that's totally unwarranted, because basically testing fundamentally is you're testing an individual. And so the extent to which the individual mirrors whatever you think about the group, you can't make those assumptions, because that person is an individual. Individuals vary along a continuum of a number of behaviors. And so, you know, one of the basic things that we need to correct as academics and psychometricians is that you can't stereotype whole groups as, oh, this group has had these experiences, this group has been prevented from having these other experiences. You can't do that. There's no data on that, number one. And the reality is that within any group, you have a range of backgrounds, a range of abilities, a range of talents. And so your best way to interpret tests is how this test performs with an individual, not a group. An individual is not a stereotype representative of whatever you think the group is. Because usually if you have these stereotypes about groups, inevitably you're wrong on many accounts.
That's good to remember, because psychology really is fundamentally about the behavior of individual organisms. And yes, they are often within communities and families. And if you're studying animals, they may be in other groups. But, you know, it's fundamentally a science that focuses on individuals. And when we lose sight of that, we do start to fall into these incorrect beliefs about a variety of things, including test bias. Could we eliminate the problem of test bias if we just norm tests separately for each group? For example, only comparing Asian Americans to other Asian Americans, or only comparing female examinees to a female norm sample? Would that solve the problem of test bias?
The short answer to that is no. And the reason why is that we've already had an example in the past of someone who tried to do that. In the 70s, there was a test that was being heavily promoted in school psychology called the SOMPA. It was S-O-M-P-A, System of Multicultural Pluralistic Assessment. And it was developed by, I think her name was Janet Mercer. And what she did in California at that time is she made that exact argument. She argued, and again, she was operating from the perspective of groups as units. And she would basically argue that different groups have different backgrounds and sociocultural experiences. So what we need to do is we need to interpret tests from the perspective of what she called race norming. So what she did is that she looked at the distribution of WISC IQ scores within each group. And of course, you had a lot of variance within each group, but the mean was different. So in this group, you would have, you know, low score to high score, but maybe in another group, it would be this, another group, it would be this. And what she would argue is that we should treat the percentile rank within each group as essentially being the same score. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you were in group A and your score was at the 90th percentile, that would be the same as a score in the 90th percentile of group B, even though group B had a higher or lower mean. And so she called that score estimated learning potential. And what she did is she race normed within each group and she treated percentile ranks as the same. So if you were in group A, you might have gotten a score on the WISC of, let's say, 120. But if you were in, and that would be the 90th percentile, let's say. But then in the other group, you might have gotten a score of 103. And that might be the 90th percentile in the other group. She would argue that the 90th percentile score is essentially the same. And she thought that was being fair within each group. Studies were done on estimated learning potential scores, and we basically saw that they did not predict as accurately as regular IQ scores. So even when you have separate norms within groups and you try to equalize the percentiles, it was a disaster. And basically, after a few years, it basically disappeared off the scene. For a variety of reasons, but that was one of the reasons. So race norming scores is not advocated as a way to make testing more fair.
It's one more example. You try some sort of alternative because you have this false belief that the test is biased, and you end up with an alternative that's less accurate, lower quality data.
Yeah.
People have been trying for 100 years to dethrone IQ tests. And
yeah.
I would be thrilled if we found something even more accurate or better, but it hasn't come along yet. And until it does, we're in the psychology world, we are going to be using these tests, and sounds like they withstand every argument about bias that's been thrown at them for your whole career
and longer. And let me give you a somewhat encouraging antidote. And I have to be very careful here because I don't want to say names or what have you. And I do want to say, as a disclaimer, this is just a personal anecdote. And personal anecdotes are not, you aren't to build truth on just one anecdote. But I just say this to give you an example of where tests are very valuable. And I'll just, take it from there, or you can take it from there. But in this personal anecdote, in my extended family growing up, and by extended family, I mean second and third cousins and second and third uncles or what have you.
I'm impressed. I don't know many of my second cousins.
Yeah. This was an example. There was a single mother who basically had a male child. And if I were to show you a picture of where this single mother lived, you would definitely say that this is a poor section of town. It was a very low income, inner city kind of situation. And so I was a young child at the time, but when this single mother had her son, we noticed from an infant on up, he was just jabbering all the time. And as he was growing up, he just talked, and he was very verbal He would understand things, and he would put things together, and he would just talk. And so even as a young child, I knew nothing about intelligence, but I knew something was unusual about this little boy. So as I grew up and as I observed him growing up, anything he touched academically, he went to the top.
Wow.
Elementary school to the top, middle school to the top, high school to the top. And he was so bright that, as he went off to college, he studied very, very advanced areas of medical research, okay? And so my point in telling that story is, here is a kid that comes from a very, very impoverished background, but yet from birth, you could see that this kid had a super high IQ. And so one of the advantages of having a well-developed intelligence test is that you want to identify kids like that that you would normally think would not have a high academic ability or what have you, but he had it, and it was evident. And he, you know, you would give him an IQ test, and he would basically run circles around it. So, you know, the stereotype that, you know, certain groups don't do well on IQ tests because of their circumstances, their backgrounds, it's just not true. You find high IQ individuals within all ethnic and racial groups.
Oh, definitely.
And IQ tests are the primary way to identify those children.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Craig, for taking the time to talk with us. Again, the name of the book is Essentials of Evaluating Bias in Intelligence Testing. It's part of the Essentials of Testing series from Wiley. You can get it on Amazon. I have my e-version from Google Books. If you've enjoyed this episode, please also check out our previous episodes. We have a great chat with Yvonne Krupin about executive functioning being measured cross-culturally. It's related a lot to some of the topics we talk about here. And also with Gilles Gignac talking about artificial intelligence and human intelligence and the similarities and differences between those and how do you give an IQ test to an AI. Please also like and subscribe, and then follow Riot IQ on YouTube. And then check out the descriptions for links to Greg's book, the social media accounts for Riot. And thank you for watching.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for coming.